this is an opportunity for people to take a good look at what our best scientists have put together and make sure that we get their local knowledge incorporated with this as well.
The EPA starts field hearings on the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, hope for advances in colon cancer screening for Alaska Natives.
Here they had one of the world's highest rates of colon cancer and one of the world's poorest outcomes in terms of survival.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org.
The federal trial for the founder of the Peacemakers Militia, Francis Schaefer Cox, and two militia members, Coleman Barney and Lonnie Vernon, continued in Anchorage today. Kyle Hopkins is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News and is covering the trial. He says the defense brought Cox to the stand yesterday and today, working to portray him as someone concerned about citizen and family safety, not a violent threat to law enforcement.
Today, I think what they're trying to do is they're just trying to hammer home this point that the origin of the militia was not one of aggression. I think we heard Cox say, make at least three references to Gandhi, you know, or comparing the militia to Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela, or at least the philosophies of those people. And trying to portray the group as one that was not interested in bloodshed or attacking government authorities, but one that was like this protective force that wanted to achieve, that felt like there needed to be a new form of government, or that the current U.S. government was falling apart, but was not trying to, you know, hasten that by going to war with the government, but instead was going to kind of rise up, you know, after the collapse, and that whatever change that they would kind of affect themselves would be, you know, through nonviolent means, through speaking or, you know, coalitions, stuff like that.
Is he being cross-examined by the prosecution today?
Yeah. And we've had about an hour maybe of cross-examination. And what that's looked like is this very aggressive attempt to discredit, you know, just to blow holes in Cox's credibility, to catch him in lies. For example, you know, the prosecutor is saying, come on, you didn't really have 35. You know, here we keep hearing you say in these speeches that you have 3,500 militiamen under your command, but that's not true, is it? You ought to knock another couple zeros off of that number. And he said, you know, he concedes, well, yeah, that was a bluff. You know, he concedes that that wasn't true, but he was kind of counting all the people and what he considers to be this, like, liberty movement in the state. So it's that kind of thing. They're playing clips in court right now where the jury's hearing him in these interviews where he's referring to everyone who's not, you know, in a militia or on the side of the government. Like, everyone in between is kind of inconsequential. They're the spoils of war. They're kind of this chattel that will just kind of go to the victor, you know, either the government, which in Cox's view is the tyrants, or kind of the heroes, which in his view is, you know, the militia members.
And how has Cox sort of emotionally weathered the cross-examination? Is he upset? Is he staying calm? How is his demeanor?
He's calm. He's been, you know, there's a reason that he was invited to speak so often, that he did so many radio interviews. He's well-spoken. He's, in his way, he's charismatic for sure. On the stand, he brings that confidence to the stand. One interesting thing today has been to see the prosecutor will ask him a question. He'll kind of answer it, but won't like the question. He'll ask a question back, you know, which is kind of challenging the prosecutor's authority. And then the prosecutor will just kind of ignore that question back. So there's been this kind of interesting exchange that you don't see very often in a courtroom, because everyone is, you know, because usually the defendant is really, really interested in playing by those rules.
Any surprises at all with Schaefer Cox on the stand, Kyle?
No, I mean, this is someone who has kind of stood up and, you know, has taken court appearances as, you know, a venue to kind of put the system on trial, you know, that kind of thing. And it's not nothing like that. I mean, there's a lot at stake for him. There's, you know, much of his life behind bars at stake for him. So he's, you know, there have been no outbursts one thing that he does that I imagine might be compelling is that he kind of, you know, he will often speak directly to the jury. You know, when he's answering questions, he's, you know, you can tell he's kind of looking to make a connection with the jurors at times.
Do you get any sort of a sense about how this may affect the outcome of the trial, having him on the stand?
It's hard to say. I mean, you could put yourself in the shoes of the jury, and you could imagine that at times both sides are scoring points. The defense, of course, is trying to show that, look, for all their talk, these guys weren't actually going to do anything. It's hard to guess how a jury's going to, what they're going to be swayed by.
Kyle Hopkins is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Colon cancer is the second deadliest cancer for men and women in the U.S. behind lung cancer, and Alaska Natives suffer from especially high rates of the disease. Now, a new colon cancer screening test is in the final stages of the FDA approval process. As APRN's Annie Feit reports, it was developed by a Mayo Clinic doctor who visited rural Alaska and saw the problem firsthand.
When Mayo Clinic Dr. David Alquist took a trip to the Bethel area in the mid-1990s, a startling statistic caught his attention. Alaska Natives were, and still are, twice as likely to get colon cancer and die from the disease as U.S. whites.
Here they had, you know, one of the world's highest rates of colon cancer and one of the world's poorest outcomes in terms of survival from cancer because of late diagnosis.
The best way to prevent colon cancer is through a colonoscopy, but Dr. Alquist realized traditional screening methods had flaws in rural Alaska. Colonoscopy equipment isn't available in remote villages, and a widely used test that detects blood in stool isn't effective because many Alaska Natives have a stomach bacteria called H. pylori that also causes bleeding. So when he returned to the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Alquist began working on a new kind of test. He wanted it to be highly accurate, accessible to anyone, and easy to use. The test he developed can identify several altered genes that are only present in colon cancer.
It measures DNA changes that are shed from the surface of cancer or precancers into the stool, and we can detect those changes that act as a signature of the presence of cancer or polyps. And it proves to be very accurate.
According to two studies published this year, the DNA test finds 85% of colon cancers and more than 50% of precancerous polyps. Alquist and the Mayo Clinic are working with a company called Exact Sciences to commercially develop the test, and both will benefit financially if it comes on the market. Alquist says the test could represent a revolution for colon cancer screening, much like the Pap smear did for cervical cancer half a century ago.
The Pap smear took a target cervical cancer, which at that time in the 50s was the number one killer in women in the United States, cancer killer among women. Now it's essentially been eradicated in women who are screened.
Predicting the DNA test could eventually make colon cancer a rare disease may sound like a bold claim, but it's one that has merit, according to Dr. Randall Burt, director of prevention at the Huntsman Cancer Institute in Utah.
Well, in the end, it could be a huge game changer.
Burt has been watching the development of the colon cancer test over the years as an outside observer, and he thinks it's fair to say the DNA test could one day be compared to the Pap smear, especially if it gets better at detecting precancerous polyps.
Is it enough to replace colonoscopy so that we only do colonoscopy on people with a positive stool test? Probably not yet, but it's getting there.
In anticipation of FDA approval early next year, the DNA test is undergoing a trial at more than 100 sites in the U.S. and Canada. And Burt says it's important for the test to prove itself in that more rigorous study. Another expert in the field agrees. Dr. William Grady is a researcher at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle. He's working on another version of a DNA stool test for colon cancer detection. Grady says DNA tests are also in the works for a long list of cancers, including lung, pancreatic, and brain cancer. He says the tests will transform the way cancer is diagnosed and even treated.
That's very exciting. I think we're going to really see some revolution in the way we take care of patients who have cancer.
In Alaska, there's hope Dr. Ahlquist's colon cancer DNA test could help make the disease less deadly. In February, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium began a 3-year trial of the test. 100 patients have enrolled so far. Janet Kelly is cancer surveillance director at ANTHC. She says the test holds a lot of promise for Alaska Natives.
Until we can find a cure for this cancer, the best tool we have is to screen, and early detection is through this test offers a lot of opportunity.
The colon cancer screening rate for Alaska Natives in some rural areas of the state is as low as 23%. In urban areas, it's closer to 60%. The DNA test could level the playing field, making colon cancer screening as accessible to someone in Shishmaref as it is to someone in Anchorage. It's expected to cost about $300, far less than the average colonoscopy in Alaska, and it could be available as soon as the middle of next year. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans turn out to watch the Venus transit.
My 5-year-old daughter, the next time this happens, would be 110 years old.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted. Make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
It was standing room only at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium, where nearly 900 people showed up for a presentation and public comment on the EPA's draft assessment of the Bristol Bay watershed. KSKA's Daisha Eaton was there and has the story.
140 people were allowed to comment on the document for 2 minutes each. Werner Wilson, an Alaska Native commercial fisherman originally from Dillingham, praised the EPA for stepping in to help his people protect their resources.
Pebble deposit may be on state land, but this is an international resource. This is a national resource, and this is a resource that is important for local people.
The draft assessment, which was released last month, tries to quantify the risks of large-scale mining to wetlands and rivers with fish. The Parnell administration calls it premature and has pledged to fight if the EPA invokes its 404(c)(3) veto power over the project. Many who testified accused the EPA of treading on states' rights. Republican State Senator Kathy Geisel used her 2 minutes of testimony to chastise the agency.
The unprecedented preemptive action by the EPA will destroy Alaska's future as a resource utilization state, destroying jobs and future opportunity for our citizens.
But retired state Senate president turned anti-Pebble activist Rick Halford had a different take. He said the state was actually to blame for the feds getting involved.
The state's lacks enforcement of water quality standards, of water use permits, the state's joining with those who work against and worked against the citizens who tried to sue and go to court. We see the Pebble mine in the state of Alaska against Alaska citizens in numerous lawsuits. You are not here as someone coming from outside. You're here at the request of the original people of the area and the overwhelming majority of the population of the area.
John Shively, the CEO of the Pebble Partnership, the Alaska company which stands to gain a considerable sum if the mine goes through, said the EPA was moving too fast.
It's rushed. Why a hearing only 2 weeks after the report is out? Why only 60 days to comment? What is the rush? I mean, if your science is good, people should have the time to look at it.
Some called for the comment period on the assessment to be extended. Dennis McLaren, administrator for the EPA's Region 10 office in Seattle, says that request is under consideration. Meantime, he says he wants people to know that this week is their opportunity to contribute to the assessment.
This is an opportunity for people to take a good look at what our best scientists have put together and make sure that we get their local knowledge incorporated with this as well.
The EPA is holding meetings on the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment in Dillingham and Naknek today. In addition, there will be meetings in Leavelock and Igiagig on Wednesday and Nundalton and Noustuyahawk on Thursday. EPA officials used the Anchorage meeting to announce that they've appointed a team of scientists to their peer review panel. The public has 30 days to submit questions for the scientists to answer. Their report will be included in the final version of the EPA's Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment, which is due out by the end of the year. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A proposed hydroelectric project in south-central Alaska has drawn hundreds of comments from concerned Alaskans. The Susitna-Watana Dam is expected to provide rail belt energy needs for 100 years, but at what cost? KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission closed a public comment period on the initial licensing stages of the Susitna Dam on June 1st. The Alaska Energy Authority filed pre-application papers with FERC last December and started a timeline rolling for construction of the $4 to $5 billion project. But FERC approval is needed to start the clock ticking. AEA Hydro Project Manager Wayne Dyock says the comments received indicated that more study needs to be done.
We have been working with resource agencies and stakeholders to develop an extensive study plan. And quite frankly, the more participation we receive from stakeholders, the more robust the study plans we can develop.
Dyock says the comments provided good feedback for project planners. The hydro project is slated for Mile 84 on the Susitna River. It is expected to create a 39-mile-long lake while it provides 600 to 800 megawatts of power for the rail belt. The hydro project has the blessing of the state, but some opposed to the dam say many of the comments received during the public period expressed concerns about the impact of the massive dam to fish and game habitat and to the watershed of the Susitna River in general. Richard Leo heads the Coalition for Susitna Dam Alternatives. Leo says he's tracked the comments through FERC's website. He says wintertime electricity needs will demand more water flow from the dam, and that will cause some major problems downstream.
The amount of water that's going to be released in the wintertime is going to increase the flows up to 400 or 500%, and those flows will certainly impact any salmon, fry, or juveniles that may be in the main stem, but it's also going to disrupt the ice. There will be no chance for safe travel.
The state legislature approved $65 million for the hydro project last year. If built, the Susitna-Watana Dam would be 700 feet high and would harness the waters of the Susitna River. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A letter of intent recently signed by UAA and the Seattle University School of Law moves Alaskans one step closer to a new law program. The move is to expand a decade-long partnership already existing between the two universities called the Summer Law in Alaska program. APRN's Josh Edge has the story.
The details of the program are still fuzzy, but Stephanie Nichols with the Seattle University School of Law says the students would likely take as many courses as possible in Alaska, but spend some time in Seattle.
Our hope and our goal is to expand what we're already doing here, where we offer courses in the summer, but really expand that into something more with the opportunities for Alaskans, whether that be locally here in Anchorage or elsewhere, as well as rural Alaska, with the intent to reach out to those folks as well, to provide them opportunities to receive a legal education.
And when can you start applying?
I think that's sort of the million-dollar question right now.
That's UAA Assistant Provost Monica Kane. She says the joint program still needs final approval from Seattle University School of Law faculty and the Alaska Bar Association, but she's hoping that happens fast.
We are looking to push this forward as quickly as we can and hoping that we can implement as soon as possible.
Kane says that input from those in Alaska's legal community will be very important in the development of the program. Hannah Siebold is the president of the Alaska Bar Association.
The Bar Association absolutely welcomes improving legal education opportunities for Alaska and Alaskans, and Seattle University has already demonstrated a sound basis of promoting intern programs that enhance access to justice, and it is our hope that this collaboration can serve to enhance the provision of legal services in rural Alaska.
Kane says the Juris Doctorate awarded by the program would be given by the Seattle University School of Law. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922, on the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
For the second time this century, Venus is making its way across the sun. Alaska and Hawaii are among the best spots in the world to view the transit, and in Anchorage, hundreds of people are lining up behind telescopes to see it, including an astronomer at the University of Alaska. APRN's Wendy Jonasson reports.
On the top floor of a three-story parking garage in the middle of campus, Dr. Andy Puckett, his students, and visitors from as far as Mexico City are setting up telescopes for a free public viewing. But you wouldn't expect duct tape to be involved.
We're putting a filter on here so that when people look into it, because we don't have a fancy sun funnel for this one.
Puckett is duct taping special filters to telescopes to protect viewers' eyes from UV light. These are not high-powered telescopes, and Puckett says that's not necessary for this event.
A half dozen telescopes up here, some of which are ours that we dug out, some of which are, one of which is actually mine from home. They're all relatively small. They're all just a few inches in diameter, actually. A student worker of mine is rolling out the big 8-inch right now, which is the biggest one that we're going to have.
Even if you can't make it to a special viewing, Puckett says you can see the Venus transit anywhere you can see the sun, but he recommends protective eyewear.
We will see a black disk on the sun that is about 1/30th the diameter of the sun. The little black dot of Venus will be just on the limit of what the human eye can see. It will move in a straight line across the sun for about 7 hours.
The last time this happened was fairly recent, 2004, but the next time won't be for over a century. So why would anyone care about a little black speck moving across the sun? Puckett has thought about that a lot.
My 5-year-old daughter, the next time this happens, would be 110 years old. So just think, the next time this happens in the year 2117, an entirely new population of humans, almost no one who is alive today, will see it. And I think people, it snaps people out of their daily, weekly, monthly, yearly planning. We can't think past a couple of years into the future. And this is, 105 years before it will happen again.
Puckett says an event like this makes us realize how short our lives are compared to the grander time scales of the universe. And how often do you get a chance to have that kind of experience? In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonasson.
Hundreds of people also turned out in Fairbanks to witness the Venus transit. KUAC's Emily Schwing was there.
Here you go, guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Martha Waro is the education and public outreach lead for NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory in Maryland. I caught up with her just as Venus started to cross in front of the sun. She was handing out little paper sunglasses.
These are solar viewing glasses. You can safely view the sun with them.
Okay.
We're hoping that Venus will be visible enough to be able to see with these glasses.
Okay.
You need to have pretty good vision. Okay. For that, because Venus is quite small.
I have 20/20 vision, so can I give it a shot?
Sure.
Okay.
You can see it?
Yeah, take a peek. I'm Martin Gutowski. I'm the coordinator for the Fairbanks Astronomical Unit, and it's pretty neat because you won't see it again in my lifetime and probably nobody else's.
So are you going to be here all day?
Yeah, we'll be here till the rain.
Gutowski turns from his telescope to point at a wall of sinister black clouds. The last Venus transit took place in 2004, but he wasn't able to see it then. A wildfire burning close to Fairbanks had filled the sky with smoke.
Why is Fairbanks such a great place to see the Venus transit?
Because we are so close to summer solstice. The sun is just about as high as it's going to get. And we don't have sunset to speak of. You can't beat it.
Near Gutowski stands Venus researcher Dr. Robbie Herrick.
Venus is doing nothing different. It stays the same distance from the sun. It just happens to be in our line of sight. But other than that, it's just another day on Venus.
In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing. Can I have one more look?
Yeah, let's see if it's still there.
I see it.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. Thank you so much.
It's just so hard to think about the sun having something in front of it that big that makes it look so small.
The cruise ship MS Amsterdam is set to make the first of 7 visits to Homer this weekend, but as KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, Holland America Cruise Lines has decided the ship will not be visiting Homer, Kodiak, or Anchorage after this year.
When Holland America Cruise Lines unveiled its 14-day Alaskan Explorer Tour 2 years ago, it offered something new for Alaska cruise ship visitors, a look at off-the-beaten-path port towns that most passengers never get to see.
Kodiak, famous for its Russian heritage and giant Bruins. Idyllic Homer on the shores of the Kenai Peninsula.
And the tour has been very popular, too. According to Holland America Public Relations Director Eric Elvjord, the Alaskan Explorer has sold out every cruise since its inception. However, Holland America has decided to discontinue the 14-day Alaska Explorer Tour.
The primary reason for that for us is that we've got a lot of cruise tour assets up in Alaska, hotels, motor coaches, rail cars, and tours that we also offer. And we're looking to expand and utilize that in a better way.
Beginning in 2013, the MS Amsterdam will return to a more traditional 7-day cruise through the Inside Passage in southeast Alaska, stopping in ports like Juneau and Ketchikan, where Holland America owns its own offshore tours, lodgings, and other amenities. Homer City Manager Walt Reedy was a bit surprised to hear the news. He says that surveys done by the city said that passengers from the Amsterdam loved visiting Homer.
One of the things people seemed to like the most was just looking at the harbor. They got to view a real working Alaska town. It wasn't all, you know, oriented toward taking money from cruise ship passengers.
The timing of Holland America's decision is interesting because the city of Homer is just now getting ready to use $8 million in state funds that are earmarked for cruise ship improvements. Among the projects the money will be used for, says Reedy, are the replacement of the fendering system at the Deepwater Dock, that's where cruise ships and other large vessels come into the port, construction of a paved staging area at the dock, including new restrooms and a new trail around the perimeter of the harbor, and completion of the Homer Spit Trail all the way to the end of the road park near Land's End Resort. Reedy says the loss of the Amsterdam's visits will not put a crimp in the plan to complete the improvement projects.
It just puts us in you know, good position to welcome cruise ships back when they decide they made a big mistake leaving Homer. And it also, it benefits everybody who comes here and anybody who lives here. I mean, we're making improvements to the dock that'll really help all vessels that call here.
In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Wendy Jonathan and Josh Edge reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.